I'd like to call this meeting of the Energy Policy Committee to order. We're starting today with Representative Bly has a bill. Some refer to it as Buy the Farm. We have 23 minutes set aside for opponents and 23 minutes for proponents. And then we'll be moving on to a weatherization presentation. So we've got the committee hearing divided in half. It's my understanding that the proponents have divided the time amongst themselves, but we will let Representative Bly present his bill and his proposed amendment. We are not taking action on the bill. This is an informational hearing. And so with that, Representative Bly, please describe your bill to us.
Thank you, Chair Hartman. And I apologize for making you wait a few minutes. It's been a busy day for all of us in recovering. Anyway, the bill I have before you today was brought to me by some folks across the state who have been impacted by the CapEx 2020 line. And they came to me because of my previous experience with the bill some years ago dealing with eminent domain. And I don't want to say very much about this, but I'd like to have the testifiers or the proponents talk about it more. I just got the other day an article, and I don't know if you can see this or not, but it shows the power lines and the towers that are being built near Belle Plaine. This is the Belle Plaine Herald. And I show that only because I want to impress upon you the impact of someone who sees that kind of tower coming onto their property. It's a dramatic experience, and so it's going to change their life. It's a life-changing event, and this is one of the reasons why I feel it's important for us to hear about this and come to some conclusion about what we can do to help those folks who are seeing their lives turned around. At that point, I'd like to introduce the first speaker, Rod Crass, who can also introduce himself and say what your interest is in this particular legislation.
Thank you, and thank you, Chairwoman and members of the committee for hearing us. My name is Rod Crass. I practice law in the condemnation area, presently for landowners, but in the first half of my career representing cities, counties, school districts who had need to utilize condemnation authority given them by the legislature. In the early 70s, there was the last major 345 kilovolt line that went through Minnesota, and it created a great deal of contention, a lot of civil unrest, some destruction of poles and processes, and of farmers and other property owners who did not want to be forced to have their farms underneath these huge power lines. The legislature responded, as your chairwoman said, with a bill we refer to as Buy the Farm. And basically, Buy the Farm, in essence, said that the property owners will have the option to require the utility to condemn the entire parcel. I'm simplifying it for purposes today. It's obviously longer than that, but that's the concept. You don't have to live, or you don't have to have your farm or your stock or your cows underneath these lines, because there have always been huge questions about the impact of these kinds of lines on both people and animals. The legislature, in passing Section 216E, the Buy the Farm statute, felt, I believe, that they had come up with a good resolution and given people an option to exercise if they chose to have the entire parcel in question instead of just the small easement condemned by the utility. These are utilities that are given by the legislature the power of eminent domain, and we think and are asking essentially to have the same rules apply to them as would apply to the state or the county or the school district if they condemned your parcel. And specifically, the issue becomes whether or not all of the rights and benefits the legislature has given landowners in Chapter 117, the condemnation statute, are available to people who exercise the buy-the-farm option. The entity that's doing the condemnation in this time frame is CapEx 2020, a consortium of about 11 utilities headed by NSP, which has, as I understand, the majority share. And what the position they have taken, the utilities, is that because people exercise this option, they are voluntarily leaving their land, leaving their farms and their homes, and are as such are not displaced persons and aren't entitled to the benefits that you give anyone else, that the legislature has given anyone else who has their entire property taken. This matter came up in St. Cloud and in Buffalo last year because that line, there are two lines, and that line was done first. And in both cases, the trial judges ruled in favor of the landowners and said, of course you have those rights. By the farm statute itself says that in these circumstances, when utilities make an acquisition, the proceeding shall be conducted in the manner prescribed in 117, the condemnation statute. And so the NSP attorneys appealed those decisions. The Court of Appeals, in a 2-1 decision, overturned the trial judges and said, yes, we agree with the utilities. This is a voluntary leaving, and therefore you're not entitled to these rights. The Supreme Court has agreed to review that, and that matter is presently before the Supreme Court being briefed. Meanwhile, all of those people who have exercised their buy-the-farm option are in limbo because no one knows what rules to apply in determining the damages that they have sustained. And as a result, they all sit and wait while the lines are being built and energized, and they're exactly where the legislature didn't want to put them, living underneath these lines. So the issues that are in front of the Supreme Court and were in front of the other courts in the St. Cloud area were twofold. There was a issue about whether people were entitled to relocation benefits and whether they were entitled to minimum compensation. Hugely important, especially to dairy and other livestock farms, because if they simply aren't going to be able to exercise buy the farm if indeed they don't have all of the rights anybody else would have under Chapter 117. The costs they would have to bear are simply too great. We expect, he wasn't able to come today, but the chief author of Buy the Farm in the Senate, Jean Merriam, is going to come and at some point testify that he believes and understood the import of the law that he proposed back then was consistent, that is, that people did have those same rights. So we're asking your consideration of this bill, which will make crystal clear that everyone impacted by the farm, by these utilities condemnations, has the same rights that everyone else has if their entire parcel was condemned. They get the same benefits that you have provided in the Chapter 117. We've also suggested a couple of changes, not changes, but clarifications, because the law as originally drafted does not have time frames in which things need to be done. For instance, the time frame of when the utility has to respond to the buy the farm election. The statute gives the property owners 60 days to make their election. There is no time frame set for a response. The present CapEx attorneys are been very good about that. They're responding in 30 days, but there's nothing in the statute that makes them do that. And so we're saying give them the same 60 days to respond and then have a hearing within 90 days if there's an objection so that this process keeps moving along. The objections that we're anticipating may come to bear here include timeliness. That is, that the utilities may think they haven't had enough time to respond to this. I would simply like to point out they've been litigating this issue for over 2 years. They've gone through trial courts, the Court of Appeals. They're now in the Supreme Court. They have analyzed this and considered it ad nauseum. They have excellent lawyers, and you can count on the fact that this has been a topic of discussion amongst the utilities for an extended period of time. The people who are impacted don't want to leave their farms. A lot of these farms are century farms. They've been in the families 100 years. Those of you who know farmers know how they feel about their land. This isn't a voluntary leaving. These folks haven't been waiting for the opportunity to sell their farms to somebody. They would rather stay there. They feel they have no choice but to leave if their home or farm is impacted because of the potential medical effects on people and the potential effects on animals. So there's been that's what they are looking for. They're looking for the same rights that they would have if the state of Minnesota took their farm for a park. And that's the nub of it. And I think that's probably enough for me. I'd like you to hear from some of the people impacted, if that makes some sense, unless you have some specific questions.
I think we'll wait till the end of the presentation for questions. We'll hear both sides of the argument, and then we'll do questions. So next we have Julie Schwartz.
I'd like to introduce Julie Schwartz. She and her husband have a dairy farm in Sibley County.
And Ms. Schwartz, if you can state your name for the record, and then go ahead.
Sure. Hi, I'm Julie Schwartz from Sibley County, and my husband back there is the redhead, Dale, and we run a dairy and crop farm. We have 100 cow dairy, 575 acres, all of which one of our farms is being affected by this transmission line. It's going through five of our six properties. It's coming down our driveway, which is where the line coming down our driveway right onto our yard. We have about a third mile plus driveway. It's a long driveway with a little S in it. And this transmission line, and I wish you could see it, because when they put these towers up last month, it is so immense that unless you're up to it, you just do not realize how big these towers are. And it's coming down our driveway through the along the property line to the next property. Like I said, we run 100 cow dairy, and dairy's 10 to 12 times more susceptible than people. Our cows are 400 feet. Our first cows are 400 feet away from this line. Between there, we have machine sheds, a couple machine sheds. We have our bin set up, and we have two cement slabs where we put our silage and our haylage. Our cement slabs, part of that is in the easement itself. So by rights, if they wanted to, they could destroy part of our cement. And besides, between the cement and the line, we also put some more feed bags because we can't fit it all on the cement. So this means these poles, like I said, they're immense. They have 15-foot arms on them attached to each side. These arms, as they stick out, we will actually be driving directly underneath them every time we go up and down our driveway. We will be driving underneath them and alongside them every time I mix feed and my son twice a day, every day. Our house is a little bit further away from the cows, but not much. So this, you know, they talk about safe distances. We don't have a safe distance. We will be working under and alongside this line every day. We live there. We eat there. That's how we make our living. We are both full-time farmers. We have a son and daughter that is also part of our operation, and a son-in-law who in the worst way wants to be a part of the operation. And we're sitting here thinking, how are we going to do this? And with that in mind, we thought, okay, we went to feed meetings and talked to all kinds of experts, and we came across some people that they knew in Wisconsin that are living with this. And so we went there to meet that have cows about the same distance as we do. The difference is they have land in between where we have nothing. And so we talked to them for a few hours and asked, you know, is there any chance? is there any way that we can stay? What it did to their farm, the dairy itself, they were one of the top herds in their, or in the state probably, but certainly their county, and there were more in that area that also were the top in their county. They went from a 27,000-pound rolling herd average, and I don't know if that means anything, but a 27,000-pound herd average, even in today's, now, is a really good herd, and we're talking, I think it's maybe been 10 years ago, I'm not sure. They went down to 16,000-pound herd average. Cows died, calves died, cows aborted. It takes 6 to 10 breedings to keep these cows bred. That's huge, that's expensive. Your hope is to get cows bred between 1 and 3 breedings. To this day, because I don't know if you're aware, but you have to stay average 400 somatic cell count. And these farmers that were winning awards for low somatic cell count are now on the watch list because every day they have, you know, they're struggling because of the stray voltage issues to keep that number down. We're a very low somatic cell count herd ourselves. So we're told one of the first things that will happen is your somatic cell will skyrocket. I'm losing my train of thought. to this day, their cows get like burn-like marks, abscesses on their legs from the ground currents changing and the voltage coming up. They go around with instruments to measure stray voltage and do anything and anything they can to try and ground that, but it always is changing. Their health themselves, I mean, I didn't want to ask a whole lot of questions about that, but the husband, he can feel it at a certain level, and when it goes above that level, his whole complete body breaks out in a rash. His wife has some similar situations, but not as severe. And, of course, there's information out there, even in CAPEX's information they gave us, that there's a link to childhood leukemia that they cannot deny anymore. There's other cancers out there. They, in their information, again, they talk about it can affect pacemakers and those types of devices, pins and screws if you have hip replacements. My husband has a hip replacement. It affects TVs and cell phones and your GPS. Now, in farming, in crop farming, GPS is becoming big so that you can become more efficient. It affects that. Now, on all of our farms except one, does that mean that we can't even use that kind of equipment? So the health of our cows is one thing. They're way more susceptible. And then we have the health of our own. And honestly, we went out to Wisconsin hoping we could find a door opening saying that, yes, there's this chance that you can stay on your farm. That's not what we found. We looked at each other when we got in the car, and we said, we don't have a choice. What do they mean we have a choice? There is no choice. What's the choice? To risk our health, to watch our dairy herd fall apart? Of the other farms in the Wisconsin area, and I believe there was 4 other ones in that area, I think for sure 3 of them, if not 4 of them, all sold out. Eventually they gave up. They spent tens of thousands of dollars trying to rewire, saying it's, you know, your wiring, it's your poor managers, and they could never get back to where they were before. There's another farmer I talked to a half mile away. Other than some of the health issues, their cows did the same thing. The herd dropped from a 25,000-pound herd average down to a 16. Somatic cells skyrocketed. The breedings, 6 to 10 breedings, everything was the same. They went through all of that.
Ms. Schwartz, I know there's 3 more testifiers on your side of the argument. You got about 8 minutes left, so I don't know if you wanted to wrap it up.
So I guess I'm just here asking, please serve the intent of the law. This law was to help prevent us farmers from going through this, and the delays, all this is hurting all of us. So we want to be able to move on, and we thought that this line was going to be energized in 2015. Now we're told they're going to energize it in this coming July. we cannot just pick up our dairy. We've been looking for more than a year and a half. Pick up our dairy and move it. You have to have buildings. There's not dairy farms out there for sale, and if there is, there's not land to go with it. You need to be able to make your feed, buy your dairy. And so I'm just pleading with you to please consider this bill, because this is affecting all of our lives. It's throughout the state. It's not just us. It's people throughout this whole state with four different lines that are going through. So I really hope you consider passing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Brad Lindberg.
Do you want to have a couple of comments? So that
at the end. Do you want to provide comments at the end or right now?
No, I'm just saying you want to have a couple. Excuse me. You want to have a couple come up to speed things along.
Sure. Next is Chris Miner, if you want to come up. Mr. Lindberg, go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed.
My name is Bradley Lindberg. My wife and I own and operate a 63-acre farm in Clearwater where we raise cattle, hogs, goats, horses, and hay. In June of 2010, CapEx 2020 informed us that our property was in the path of a proposed route for their planned 350 kV high-voltage power line. And that they required a 7.5-acre easement across our property along I-94. The easement would give them the right to drive through our farmyard at any time without notice, which we felt was a serious trespass of our home privacy and safety concern for our grandchildren and pets. After much consideration, Linda and I decided to hire attorneys and utilize our statutory option to elect to have the power company buy our entire farm. Although we had no prior intention of moving from our beautiful farm, where we have lived for 23 years, we just could not bear the intrusion through our farmyard and the destruction of our property that CapEx demanded with their easement conditions. On March 16, 2011, in Wright County Court, CapEx condemned the 7.5 acres of our farm along the interstate. They proceeded to move our fences, cut our trees, and put their power line across our property. where we once had a row of trees that we had planted 20 years ago and nurtured into a beautiful border along the freeway, we now have five unsightly 150-foot towers with a high voltage power line. We are told that we cannot irrigate, build, or plant trees in the easement area. Our farm operation is restricted by the CapEx 2020 easement conditions, not to mention the invasion of our private property, risk of stray voltage, and safety concerns mentioned earlier. We are told these power lines are currently operating at half capacity. There is future potential for another 350 kV line on the same towers, meaning there will be even more risk to our farm and family. Since CapEx condemned our property, we have experienced endless stalling tactics from CapEx, uncertainty of our future due to the long delay, and no end in sight. We will have allowed them access through our farmyard and homestead according to their condemnation requirements, and they proceeded with the erection of their towers. While they have failed to make commitments and trudge along, they accused us of being unreasonable, questioned our intentions, required us to have inspections of septic systems and property, driven our attorney's costs, and even doubted the commercial viability of our property. CapEx has invaded every facet of our lives: financial burden, psychological strain, constant worry, spiritual duress, and physical stress. We feel as if they are making examples of landowners such as Linda and I by making their invasion through our private property as difficult as they can. They have moved their project through our property, and their high voltage lines are up and running while our lives have been in limbo for more than 2.5 years. We need resolutions so we can get on with our lives. We support the proposed legislation to give us some certainty and clarity what we believe the Buy the Farm law originally intended. It is my understanding that the reason for the Buy the Farm statute that the legislation passed was to give protection to landowners who are burdened with the very high voltage power lines over their properties. I understand the logic that the legislation granted the power lines of eminent domain to these power companies, and in doing so said, if you condemn the landowner's property, you must allow them the option to have their properties taken. The power company can can then resell the property with the imposed restrictions of the easement attached. We can assure there is nothing voluntary about this taking of our property. Before this high voltage power line came across our land and forced their access to the easement area through our farmyard, we had no intentions of moving. The move of our farm and the financial and personal price of buying a new operation is great, and we believe these power companies should pay the cost under the laws, just like any other public agency does. We don't want a handout, we just want what the laws affords us, and we ask that you make it clear that when people like us face this type of involuntary condemnation, we are eligible for all the condemnation rights that are in the state's laws. We believe that the farmers and landowners like us should get the same rights as anyone else receives when their property is taken by the government. Two district court judges, one appeals court have said, and one appeals court judge have said so, and now we ask that you do the same. Thank you for listening to my story, and we request that you support the landowners and citizens who find themselves in this predicament.
Thank you, Mr. Lindberg, for your testimony. Next, we have Chris Miner, and we are running long. We're at time for your side, but we'll go a couple minutes extra if you can be succinct. And I know Tom Peterson from the Farmers Union can be succinct. So, Mr. Miner, go ahead and introduce yourself and then proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, committee members. My name is Dave Minar. My son, Chris, is sitting behind me. We own Cedar Summit Farm in southern Scott County, about 2 miles north of New Prague. It's a farm that my grandfather purchased in 1926. We milk about 130 cows, and we have a creamer on our farm, Cedar Summit Dairy. We market our milk all over the Twin Cities and at your food co-ops and many other stores around the area. We grow about 450 acres of cropland and pasture. CapEx condemned an easement on our property at the end of January. And via our attorneys, we invoked our statutory option to have the power company buy our farm. The reason we did this is because we believe Cedar Summit can't be sustainable in its current form beside a high-voltage power line. Our farm's basic business model has its foundation in two differentiating factors. The first is the uniqueness and aesthetics of our local family farm. Our customers are hooked as soon as they travel and walk our pastures. We get them to do this through dinners out in the pasture, pasture tours, in our annual Milkapalooza event, which takes place toward the end of June. What hooks our customers is the education they get and the aesthetics of the organic grass pastures. Having large power lines over the pastures completely changes this value. As an example, one of our customers, his favorite dinner site was up on a hill there within yards of the proposed power line. The current mayor of Minneapolis was at the dinner a couple of years ago in that location, and you could ask him if he would enjoy it more within yards of a power line. I understand we use electricity and we need the power lines. However, the fact that our customers value our product at least is part due to the aesthetic differentiation from what they see in the cities. The second reason, some of our products are differentiating benefits because of the health benefits, and these are derived from the organic pasture grasses that we grow. There is data showing the impact of high voltage power lines to conventional agriculture. However, this system, agriculture, is not completely dependent on the natural biome cycles like our system is. To date, we have not found research that tells us what we can expect on our farm. And we're not interested in being the subject of that research. Finally, we are also concerned about many safety aspects of the line, which are too numerous to discuss here. for our organic dairy farm, CapEx really takes by the farm off the table for us. There's no possible way we can afford to move our farm without minimum compensation and relocation expenses. So if the CapEx position is allowed, the buy the farm rights that the legislature gave us don't exist. We need your help if the buy the farm rights are to have any meaning for us. It takes us 3 years to certify our land, so if we move, it would be really a burden for us, and it takes decades to get pastures to grow like they are. So, thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Tom Peterson, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. I'll just be very briefly to speak in support of Representative Bly and thank him for carrying this legislation. I think you've heard we've worked on eminent domain for many years on these issues, and we have always were under the understanding that we had to buy the farm as the ultimate backup. But now we're starting to feel like the buy the farm is not the ultimate backup plan for the farmers like you've heard today, and that this legislation would go a long way to impacting that. I've been surprised over the summer the amount of calls I've gotten from farmers in Pope and Stearns and Scott and Sibley counties about these issues, and they're all the same, but they haven't talked to each other, and it's been a very interesting issue to me. Our basic position is that we understand that we're going to have roads and bridges and power lines. We're just asking for the farmers to be justly and fairly compensated when this occurs. So thank you for consideration of this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson, and thanks for being speedy. We have two testifiers who have signed up with the committee to testify with concerns about the bill. Dan Lesher from Great River Energy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Lesher, and I work with CapEx 2020. I am a route lead and land rights lead for the project. It's important to note that on a day-to-day basis, I work with landowners and constituents and many local government units working on questions that come up with CapEx projects. And I really appreciate the time you've given me today to address you and discuss CapEx. Before I get into the buy the farm law specifically, I'd like to just talk to you a little bit about CapEx itself. It's a joint initiative of 11 utilities. Those utilities are essentially a group of investor-owned, cooperative, and municipal utilities, and they serve the majority of Minnesota and the surrounding regions. The goals of CapEx are quite simple. The goals are to expand and rebuild the existing electrical infrastructure, and in doing so, continue to provide safe, reliable, and economical electricity for our customers and communities alike. In addition to providing that electricity, we are opening up the transmission capacity to really support renewables as we move forward. The CapEx group consists of five projects, four of which are 345 kilovolt transmission lines, and one of which is a 230 kilovolt transmission line. These transmission lines combined mileage is about 800 miles of transmission throughout, and also comes at an investment cost of about $2.2 billion. So in order to start walking down the path of how these projects come to be, I'd like to just talk a little bit about the routing and the permitting that are needed for these types of projects. When a 345 kilovolt transmission line is proposed in Minnesota, you need two types of permits, the first being a certificate of need and the second being a route permit, both of which come from the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. These permits take a long time to get and are a long, complex public involvement process, and on average take about 3 to 4 years to get. So these projects have all been in the public eye for quite some time now. So as we move forward and we secure route permits, which we have from the majority of these projects, the first thing to do, first part of the project process as we move forward, is to work with landowners on acquiring the easement itself, which for the Brookings and other projects, the CapEx project, is 150-foot easement, 75 feet from the center of the transmission line itself. Whenever possible, we follow the routing rules are to try and utilize existing rights of way. Those may be roads, highways, railroads, or in some cases, transmission line corridors. If none of those are available, property lines, section lines, other natural divisions of property are utilized in order to try and minimize the impact on residents. So as we move forward with the agents and working with landowners, and as we have heard from the testimony prior to myself, what we want to try and do is meet with property owners and talk to them about the project, try and answer a lot of their questions, which oftentimes there are many questions that come up. And as you heard from the testimony today, every property is unique. Every property owner has got a unique case, whether it's a dairy farm or an organic farm. All of these types of factors we have to account for when working with property owners, and certainly valuing the easement as we move forward. We don't take this lightly. We understand that it's a very stressful and complex process for many landowners. 150-foot steel pole on somebody's property is a big deal, and we take that very seriously, and we have been working and will continue to work with property owners diligently to try and resolve any questions. But what we want to, what our main goal is to try and answer questions and make sure that property owners have are able to make an informed decision when looking at whether or not to sign an easement document with us. In some cases, however, we're unable to come to consensus on the value of the easement. In Minnesota, there is a very well established, fair, and comprehensive eminent domain process in place that is overseen by the court system to help resolve differences. And in those cases, ultimately the value of the easement would be determined by a panel of commissioners that would be set forward by the court in that particular county. The utility pays just compensation for the easement acquired. Just compensation includes not only the amount for the easement itself, but also any reduction in value caused by the property beyond the easement. It's important to note the landowners still own that property. This is not a fee taking, this is an easement. They are free to use that property in any manner they see fit. There are two restrictions that are basically placed on that property, the first being structures within that easement area, and also tall growing vegetation, both of which could become a safety hazard moving forward. So we do ask that that not be a part of the easement area. However, for farmers in agricultural areas, you're free to use that existing easement and continue to farm that property, use it for access, or any other number of uses that may be. In Minnesota, the Power Plant Siting Act provides certain landowners with the ability to require the utility to not only condemn the easement area, but to condemn more of the property than just the easement itself. This is commonly known as the Buy the Farm election. The Buy the Farm statute was passed in 1977. According to the Minnesota Supreme Court, the purpose of the Buy the Farm statute is to provide certain landowners not wishing to be adjacent to such rights of way the opportunity to obtain expeditiously the fair market value of the property and go elsewhere. The Buy the Farm statute eases the difficulties of relocation by shifting the transaction costs of locating a willing purchaser for the burdened property from the landowner to the utility. The Buy the Farm statute, however, has certain conditions that need to be met in order for the election to be valid. First and foremost, the transmission project itself has to be 200 kV and above. And as I mentioned, with CapEx portfolio projects, all projects fall under this category. The property itself that's in question also must fit into a certain land use zoning type classification. essentially there's six classifications, and essentially those classifications all are agricultural and residential in nature, and it prohibits the election by the farm for industrial and commercial uses. The by the farm statute further requires that elected property be contiguous to the easement and commercially viable property. The Minnesota Supreme Court has also recognized that in order to survive judicial review, a requirement of reasonableness must be read into the by the farm statute. Under the by the farm law, an eligible landowner must elect by the farm within 60 days of being served with the petition for condemnation. Minnesota is the only state in the country that has a by the farm statute, and the by the farm statute goes well beyond what other states require. In other states, utilities may use the power of eminent domain to acquire only the easement that is necessary for the construction and operation of the transmission line itself. To date, 79 owners have made formal by the farm elections or have indicated that they would like to work with the utility to actually negotiate and purchase that property without going forward with the formal by the farm process. To date, we've accepted 46 of these elections where it makes sense and the election fits all of the criteria of the by the farm statute. In certain cases, we have disagreed with the validity of the election itself. That may be because the property does not fit within the land use type. It could be because the election came after the 60-day time frame. But in many cases, it's because the election did not meet the reasonableness test that is established by the Minnesota Supreme Court. Where the parties disagree, both sides have the ability to have the dispute resolved by the district court having jurisdiction over the condemnation proceeding. As I discussed earlier, the outcome of that proceeding is similar to when we acquire an easement under condemnation. The panel of commissioners would essentially establish what the value is for the by the farm election. In the interest of our customers, we have an obligation to be mindful of project costs, as it is our customers who end up paying for these projects. We try to determine whether each owner's by the farm election meets the intent of the statute and whether it meets the reasonableness test established by the Minnesota Supreme Court. Prior to the CapEx projects, the by the farm statute had rarely been used in Minnesota. The statute really provides a framework with more definition needed as we work through projects and properties and the unique characteristics of each property. That said, on a number of occasions, we have sat down with counsel, including Mr. Crass, for many of the landowners affected by the projects, in an effort to try and establish a process that implements the statute in a fair and balanced manner. On many issues, we have had very constructive discussions and made great progress. We would welcome the opportunity to work with both legislative sponsors and landowner representatives to help make the process more efficient. When purchasing property for the CapEx projects, both easement and by the farm elected property, CapEx pays just compensation for the property it acquires. It is in the best interest of the CapEx utilities and their customers to avoid litigation expenses and to reach an agreement with the property owner as soon as possible. In closing, it is important to note that House File 338 seeks to automatically extend the right to make a claim for replacement value compensation to those owners who choose to make a by the farm election. House File 338 similarly seeks to automatically extend relocation benefits to those owners. CapEx remains committed to paying fair market value. The question regarding whether an owner who makes a by the farm election may make a claim for something beyond fair market value of the property that is being acquired is currently pending before the Minnesota Supreme Court. We expect an oral argument to be held this spring, and we expect a decision by the court by the end of the summer. We hope this will provide the clarity that we need. We are pleased to have this opportunity on behalf of CAPEX 2020 to speak and answer questions on House File 338. Again, I sincerely appreciate the time you give me today to address you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lesher. Craig Johnson from League of Minnesota Cities, and I know he can be succinct also, and then we will go to member questions, and I have Representative Quam and Representative Falk on the list. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I am not here to talk about CAPEX. Here to talk about other impacts that the bill has that are outside of that scope. And members, I wanted to take just a moment to remind people that we have talked about this before, and Representative Bly has worked very hard on this issue before. We worked with him in the 2009 and 2010 sessions to craft language which was passed into law, signed by the governor, Chapter 288, House File 1182, to change how high-voltage transmission lines and pipelines were dealt with in the eminent domain process, separate from the way other public service corporations are dealt with. And that's what I would actually like to focus on, is what's in Section 1 of the bill that you're looking at today, which is not part of the buy-the-farm provision. This is part of the overall guidance for how appraisals are done on all takings. And what is being changed is the award granted for appraisal fees is being changed for public service corporations from $1,500 to what is the case in other types of takings, which is $1,500 for single and dual family homes, but $5,000 for any other kind of property for an appraisal fee. And I think the most important thing to consider here is, what are public service corporations? They are defined in 117.025, and they are very, very expansive. It includes all of the utilities run by municipal government. So it's not just high voltage power lines. It's extensions of sewer lines, water lines, stormwater systems, municipal airports, watershed districts, drainage authorities in rural areas, and the list goes on and on. It includes cable. It includes telephone. It includes all of the various utilities that are extended to people. And this would dramatically change the awards given for appraisal fees to cite any of those public services. When eminent domain law was changed in 2006, which is when there were significant state changes made to the laws here, public service corporations were kept at a different level of consideration in this, because kind of by definition, if you're extending utilities to the public, it's meeting a specific public need, and it was considered to be in the public interest kind of by default, but the award still needs to be considered and the taking still needs to be processed through the state's appropriate procedure, like you heard the last testifier mention. But we did recognize that the appraisal fee could be limited in some way. And what you have in front of you in Section 1 right now, interestingly enough, if you look at the lines, if your bill is numbered the same as mine, it's lines 12 through 15 and 20 and 21, but it's subpoints 1 and 2 in the last sentence of the section. That's the new language we added in 2009 and 10. So that's being left. What's being deleted is all of the previous law that we wrote that around. So it's actually completely changing the intent of that section from what we crafted it to be when we worked on this issue 4 years ago. So, Madam Chair, with that, I just point out that we have a continued concern about how broadly this affects very, very many utilities, and not the 200 kilowatt or kilovolt plus power lines, but all of the other utilities that currently are not under that same burden. And I've already talked with the author. We're happy to work with them to avoid those unintended consequences, but I don't think that's part of what we're discussing here in an issue that you're hearing pretty clearly is related to a very specific instance.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Members, we do want to move to the weatherization piece as soon as possible. Remember, we're not voting on this bill today, and folks will be available after the hearing to answer questions as well. Representative Bly, did you want to make a brief comment before we go to questions?
I just wanted to say that, yes, I am willing to work with Craig Johnson, and we solved a problem like this before, and I'm confident we can solve it again. And so I wanted to thank him for coming forward and pointing
it
out.
And I do wish we had more time, but we have finite time today.
I also did have some amendments which were put forward. I can wait to deal with those when we actually hear the bill for passage or for some kind of decision, if you'd like to do that. Otherwise, I neglected to bring that.
We put the amendments on the website, and they're in members' packets, so I think if they have questions about those, you can talk to members individually afterwards.
Okay.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. the first question is to the to you in that my understanding, and as I've been told by other chairs since joining this body, that if something is in the courts, especially the Supreme Court, that we tend to avoid getting in the middle of that until a decision is made. And so, you know, understanding if that is the same general position by the chair. And then my main question for the bill, which was touched on by the last testifier, is noticing that, you know, 114, you're talking about things that are frequently below ground instead of above ground, don't have an EM field that has a debatable distance of safety dependent on strength. So some of the issues are much different for natural gas, petroleum, etc., than with high voltage power lines, and that I have a concern of the intertwining, and if we do something to mitigate without dividing the legislation, that we have unintended consequences. And I would hope that before we do take action, we would be able to address that, and hopefully the author could address that situation and avoid problems.
Representative Quam, did you want somebody in particular to answer your questions?
Well, Madam Chair, yes. You, with the position of you as chair on taking up legislative action or bills that are in the courts, especially the Supreme Court of the state, and if there's someone, and the chief author probably could cover this, the intent of dividing out or changing so we do not, you know, it's totally different, you know, science and effects of EM fields as opposed to something under the ground, and maybe there's thermal or other considerations with, you know, by the farm.
Representative Quam, to your first question, generally I'm not a big fan of the legislature intervening in litigation. However, sometimes the courts get it wrong, and they misinterpret what we intended to do in legislation. And if that happens, I think it's up to us to correct if there's a mistaken interpretation. I think we all need to learn a lot more in depth about this issue before we decide whether we're moving forward on it. Representative Blyde, to the second part of the question.
Well, and just to follow up what you were saying, I think also the intent of this is to make sure that the original intent of the statute is reflected as well. So there's concern about that. Could be up to interpretation, but that's one of the reasons to bring it forward. But to your question, Representative Quam, although I recognize there is a difference, you're right about that. I think when we're talking about volume or a large pipeline, for instance, though, there are concerns about leakage or a spill of some kind where you also want to have the same kind of protection, especially if you have an organic farm or something which would be greatly affected by such an event.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I have a question for Mr. Lesher, if he would come back to the testifier's table. I just want your thoughts on this, and I know one of the words you used were this process is fair and balanced, and whenever I hear that, I inherently think that it's unfair and biased. Maybe it's, you know, just a bias of my own, but I question that. How reasonable do you think it is that there's a 60-day time period on this? I mean, we're talking about some of these people who have farms that have been in the family for a century, to go out and find, if they're trying to elect to use the buy the farm language, to go and find a similar size site, similar size operation, similar size equipment that would allow them to continue their livelihood in a reasonable fashion. How reasonable is that 60-day window?
Mr. Lesher.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the 60-day window, the way it is in the current legislation, the 60-day window is a period for letting us know that you want to move forward with buy the farm. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be out by that period of time, or it just sets the wheels in motion. After that election has been made, there are no more timelines after that election to move forward with moving forward on the buy the farm case, and that is why we've tended to work with Mr. Crass on what each person's opinion is and what their motivation is to keep moving things forward.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You just highlighted exactly what the problem is. I mean, 60 days, 2 months is a very short period of time to go out and have you looked at what farmland's going for, how hard it is to come by? I mean, if you're going to take a farm operation and they're going to have to make the decision if they want to move and continue in their livelihood, what they've been doing maybe in their family for generations, is it even reasonable to assume that you could find property, get the equipment up and running? I mean, that's a really big decision to have to go and make in 2 months. I don't think that there's a reasonableness that's being looked at. And I'm not asking for what the court has said, but I want your interpretation or your, you know, if you feel that that would be reasonable. I mean, if the shoe were in the other foot, if you had to suddenly move, would it be reasonable for you to pick up your entire business, your entire practice, everything you were doing, and make that decision and all of its weights in a period of 60 days?
Mr. Lesher.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I understand your question, and I think that these transmission lines have been in the public eye now for the better part of 4 years, especially the project that I'm working on, and I'll speak about the Brookings project because that's the project I'm most familiar with. So as you've been working through the public process, people have known about the routing and how the process has been going. And as I made mention, when the route permit is issued and we have a final route that we work with, we spend a good deal of time, and it's not just the 60-day window. Months are spent on negotiations with property owners to talk about the easement, talk about the valuation of that easement, and then ultimately, in order to keep the timelines and the in-service dates for these transmission line projects, you know, we have to move forward at some point. And at that point, if the property owners made that decision already, and typically I would say, based on the interactions that I've had, that property owners have made those decisions long before we ever get there, because these projects have been out there, the routes have been known since, in the Brookings case, 2010. And so people have made those decisions prior to us getting there. I would also make mention that just because you make that election of buy the farm doesn't necessarily mean that you are going to leave. There have been cases where we have received buy the farm elections, but for one reason or another, those property owners have decided to stay, and that is fine too. There is not a definitive timeline once you make that election. You're just basically reserving your spot. So,
Representative Falk, anything kind of in closing?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'll just say that I think the system's incredibly unfair. It's stacked against people, stacked against landowners, it's stacked against individuals. And I had kind of a closing comment here that I want to just thank folks for stopping by and sharing your stories with us. I do appreciate you taking the time. And I apologize that you're having to go through this. I do think it's unfortunate. Some of the decisions that were made here in previous legislative sessions that allowed this bundling of transmission lines, I think, is poor policy. It makes a faceless, kind of empty organization that they're just, it's CapEx. It's not a particular individual. It's not a particular or utility, but it's this big agglomeration. And we didn't used to do it that way. It used to be utilities had to go and be responsible for their individual transmission lines. In a lot of cases, they still are, but this joint initiative is relatively new. I think it was back in 2005 it was adopted. And I also want to stress, too, that I disagree with some of the comments that this was made to support renewable energy, making this just, you know, renewables function like large central station power plants. I really don't think it works all in all that well, and there was a number of larger power plants on the drawing board at the time. Some of those, like Spiritwood, has been mothballed, and ones like Big Stone 2 didn't move forward. But still, this process and this conglomeration of transmission lines, I think, has really been put together for the better part of 10 years, and it's unfortunate. I feel sorry for what individuals are having to go up against, because you look around the room and you see that there's a lot of, you know, representation that the utilities have here that unfortunately citizens don't often have. And I'd say in final closing comments, too, with just once again how unreasonable and unfair the system is, in a lot of these cases, the attorneys that the utilities are hiring, you're paying for them with your ratepayer dollars, and it's unfortunate.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad you're holding this hearing, and I'm glad you're not taking action on the bill for a while, because these are important issues. When we put neighbors against neighbors, which is really what we're doing here with eminent domain issues, this is what happens. We hear these stories of people who are put in a really hard spot. And then in the middle, and I'm not defending the utilities, they don't need to be defended, because the utilities are government-sanctioned monopolies that we created, and then we've tasked them with doing certain things. Building a reliable grid, for one thing, which requires, just because of the laws of physics and engineering, that we have corridors where wires run down them. We haven't figured out how to put it through a pipe or how to truck it or put it on a train. It's got to run on wires. We've also done the renewable energy standard. I'm going to take direct umbrage at the comments that were just made. CapEx 2020 was in large part the responsibility of this legislature because we were heading towards a renewable energy standard that exceeded the 10% number we talked about the other day. Madam Chair, it might be helpful to revisit the CapEx 2020 rationale if you're looking for an overview someday about why that bill came about and why we put all the utilities in the same basket, all 11 of them, because we mandated all of them to live up to the renewable energy standard. That is wind heavy. It's overloaded with wind, and the wind isn't here, it's west. The load is here in the east, and there's only one way to get it from there to here, and that's build power lines. So, Madam Chair, I guess this my comments for this committee is we're tasked with weighing this very heavy issue, is that we tell people to do things and they have to do them. And that sometimes means then that public service corporations who are beholden to us and who jump as high as we tell them to jump have to go out and take people's land to accomplish a public purpose, whether it's an airport or a sewer line or a drainage ditch or a power line. They live within the eminent domain law. So I heard some undertones in some of the comments where they're made that we've got big bad companies are taking my land and making life hard. Make no mistake, land is being taken and life is being made hard. But it's not the companies doing it to you. They're doing it on our behalf. Look at us. We're the ones that are doing it to you. And we're not going to pay and the companies won't pay. Your neighbors will pay. At the end of the day, all those costs, and I think Mr. Lesher made the comment, they are required to be mindful of the cost because in the end it's the customers who pay for this. That's a fiduciary and legal responsibility that we lay on the companies to pass those costs through. So we can tell them to do whatever we want, buy the farm, buy it all. We can do that. But at the end of the day, the companies don't pay, the ratepayers pay. The co-op pays, the school pays, Target pays, your local grocery store. The list can go on. But Madam Chair, a lot of what happens here is because we think we can outthink the marketplace and we can make things happen just because we can for whatever reason. So I want to just say again, thank you for having this hearing and for letting us hear these heartfelt stories and the helping us recognize the difficult position we put people in when we monkey with the market and do things that don't really need to be done, in my humble opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a comment. I didn't know there was like three people in between, and I probably shouldn't be commenting on a legal question after 4 hours of sleep, but Representative Quam, question about whether we would be interfering with the current case, and just wanted to add that we don't necessarily have to make a determination or that the Supreme Court got it wrong, but basically we just... If we don't like something the Supreme Court does or thinks it should change or that maybe the times have changed, I mean, there's a decision, I believe it's an interpretation of the statute, and we can always change that. And so that if we decide to act, it would be prospective only, and we would not be affecting any pending proceeding. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Allen, and thank you, everybody who came to testify about the bill, and we'll, I'm sure, continue our conversations with you outside of the committee hearing process. And we're going to move to the weatherization piece, and we're going to start with Bill Grant. And members, this hearing on this bill has shown that we probably are going to have to book some extra committee time slots for when we do have the major bills that will be moving through the committee soon, because I know we're going to have a lot of questions and a lot of discussion. Mr. Grant, go ahead and introduce yourself. And I'm sorry, we are condensing 45 minutes into 22 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll try to be brief with my presentation. And I'm happy that the committee is interested in hearing more about the low-income weatherization program. We're proud of the work that's been done under the program. And just to start, I think members know this, but the Department of Commerce overall is intent on protecting the public interest, advocating for Minnesota's consumers, ensuring a strong and competitive marketplace, strengthening our economic future, and serving as a real resource for consumers and businesses throughout the state. And the weatherization program really fits within that rubric. The National Weatherization Assistance Program began in 1976, partially in response to the energy crises of the 1970s. And as you can see here, the mission is to reduce costs for low-income families, particularly the elderly, people with disabilities, and children, by improving the energy efficiency of their homes while ensuring health and safety. And Madam Chair and members, we really see this program going hand in hand with our energy assistance program, which provides cash assistance in the form of direct payment of bills for low-income consumers. This program is designed to help those very same consumers eliminate the need for that kind of more emergency-based assistance. Funding for the program comes from the Federal Department of Energy. We receive a five-year grant with one-year contracts during the grant period, and we get an annual appropriation from Congress. Funds are distributed to states through an allocation formula that's based on population county by county and on regional energy needs. The program itself is delivered through a series of 30 local service providers in districts of yours throughout the state. There are 22 community action programs, 6 Native American tribes, 1 nonprofit organization, and 1 county community development agency that deliver the program at the local level. In some cases, that program is delivered with work crews of the organization itself. In other cases, local contractors are used to perform the work. The funding that we receive provides for a number of things. Our administrative costs at the state level, training and technical assistance for local providers, local administrative costs, service provider program funds, and then training and technical assistance for all of the local service providers that we work with. We also get and have annually performed a transfer of up to 10% of the available LIHEAP, low-income home energy assistance program funds do get transferred to weatherization assistance. The Commerce Department makes that determination. The commissioner can choose from a range between 5 and 20%. Historically, that's been 5%, but last year, because we received a zero allocation from the federal government, we did transfer 10% of the available LIHEAP money to the weatherization program. Household eligibility for the program is determined by a joint application with the low-income home energy assistance program. And there is a prioritization schedule starting with the elderly, disabled, family with children younger than 18, households with high energy use, and households with high energy burden. And burden is distinguished from use. Burden would be that percentage of that family's income that's devoted to energy costs. And owners and renters have an equal opportunity to receive weatherization assistance. Minnesota really has led the way in the delivery of the weatherization program, introducing the use of technical tools such as the blower door and infrared camera to determine which energy savings measures should be installed. For those of you who don't know, a blower door basically is a device that allows us to put a low-income family's home under pressure to determine where air leaks are occurring and so that we can seal those most effectively. And Minnesota really continues to be a leader throughout the country in innovation and quality in the program. Measures that are allowed under the program are based on individual measures meeting a savings to investment ratio of one or greater. Think of this as a cost effectiveness test on each of the measures that we install. And it's based on a formula for each distinct measure, for example, insulation, new furnace, air sealing, over the life of that particular measure. For example, a furnace we would expect to last 15 years or more. So what does a qualifying low-income homeowner receive? They'll receive a high-tech energy audit that can determine which energy savings measures should be installed, in-person client education that informs recipients how to save energy in their dwellings, air sealing leaks in the building, insulation in walls, ceilings, and rim joists. Rim joists are that place where the house framing meets the foundation wall. Installation of high-efficiency furnaces and mechanical repairs and health and safety measures to protect occupants. And this is one of the things that we've learned over the years, that homes can become too tight and without adequate ventilation can cause indoor air quality problems and mold. So we have just a few pictures to show you an example of the type of work that's being done. Here is an example of insulation being installed in an attic of a home. One of the workers performing that work. This is a foam that actually expands to fill air leaks, and one of the principal areas that we look for are leaks from the occupied part of the dwelling into the attic. Those kinds of leaks not only rob the home of useful energy, but also are the leading cause of ice dams in homeowners' homes. An energy audit is the way that we use to determine whether and what kinds of measures to install, as I said, and we also perform safety tests to make sure that once a furnace is tuned, or if we're installing a new furnace, that the furnace is drafting properly, again, to protect the health and safety of the occupants. We do extensive training for state and local service providers, and this is in the form of ongoing training for all of our service providers throughout the year, and not only in the technical aspects of the program, but also in fiscal management and client education efforts. And the Department of Energy has recently focused more attention on the health and safety of people served, and while this is a good thing, it's also added some complication to the program that I know has been a struggle for local service providers. It's called Weatherization Plus, and it's required us to conform to a ventilation standard, again, that's meant to protect the health and safety of homeowners. And this is a training tool that helps workers that are working in buildings understand how they're put together so that they can correctly install measures. Here's a really bad picture that you should just ignore. But this was this was actually taken summer before last. Commissioner Rothman and I were making a visit to a weatherization site in South Minneapolis. Many states and territories had ERA funds remaining last year, which meant that those states, all of the states, received a reduction in funding to $68 million in funding to $68 million. Minnesota, perhaps foolishly, completed their work on time, spent all of the ERA money through the weatherization program that was allocated to weatherization, and we felt that we were in effect penalized for having completed our work on time. So we're now again operating under a continuing resolution from Congress with the amount to be determined later this year. But at the current amount of $68 million, Minnesota would only receive $2.5 million in the coming year against an average budget of closer to $10 to $11 million. And finally, I just wanted to point out that weatherization program really does generate useful economic output for each dollar spent on weatherization measures. They create an additional $1.09 in economic activity. We create three-quarter jobs for each existing weatherization job that we do. And for each dollar earned by a weatherization worker, 86 cents is earned by workers and throughout the rest of the supply chain of the weatherization program. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Peter, did you have anything to add? And I'd like to, Patrick McFarland and Greg Seelen to come on up. And
Madam Chair, Peter Brickwoody, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce. Just very quickly, two members should have two of these success story flyers from our weatherization program from around the state, one from residents in Minneapolis and another from a program out in Representative Faulk's district. I would also add Commissioner Grant spoke a little bit about some of the products that are used by, for example, folks who are doing home energy audits. I'd like to note that a lot of that, a lot of the equipment that is used is actually manufactured here in Minneapolis. For example, the blower doors that Commissioner Grant mentioned, there's a manufacturer in Representative Allen's district in Minneapolis that produces most of the ones that are used around the country.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwoody. Mr. McFarland from Anoka County CAP, can introduce yourself and go ahead. I'm sorry we are so time.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Patrick McFarland with Anoka County Community Action Program. It's a private, nonprofit community action agency serving Anoka County. I don't work for Anoka County. I work for the CAP, even though I do have an Anoka County badge. I've been employed there since 1973, and I've been the director since 1978. And for most of those years, we've run conservation programs in a variety of different percolations. Currently, we have the DOE weatherization program, which is not doesn't currently have any DOE money in it, but it's funded through transfer, as Bill Grant said, from the Energy Assistance Program and also from the utilities. And we believe it's very important to keep a certain infrastructure dollar available for the program. We've estimated that to be about $14 million annually to keep the whole statewide program going. The ACAP program uses a contractor-based model. We only have one employee that's exclusively funded by the weatherization program. All the other operations are done, as Bill was talking about, by contractors. And even with that, we really need certain level of funding to pay our infrastructure costs, to have some economies of scale for this program. For example, we did about 590 jobs, houses through the ARA program. We typically do about 150 houses annually in all of our programs for weatherization. And this year, we'll be doing under 80. And so with the big demand that we have, the importance of this program in terms of conserving energy, saving the families money, we believe needs to be continued, and it's a very important aspect of our programming. And we appreciate the opportunity to come and testify. Thank you for having us. And if we can be of any further assistance, we'd be happy to do that.
Mr. Seelen.
Hi, I'm Greg Seelen from Seelen Advanced Weatherization. I'm a small contractor that relies upon weatherization as a large part of my business. I am here to try to help clarify just exactly what we do in the field. I will try to keep it brief, known to be long-winded. I will probably save to answer questions. I would like to point out the fact that it is has a widespread impact on the local economies, meaning it's not just us as contractors, it's our suppliers, where we buy our gasoline, and the manufacturers of our products and such. To touch on some of the things he said for a little clarification, we do, when we go into weatherized homes, we try to, I've been involved for 30 years and watched the entire almost the entire evolution of the weatherization program, going from a widespread activities we did on the home to narrow it down to what has become cost effective using what he referred to as the savings to investment ratio, meaning we don't do much with windows or doors, even though that's what the average consumer or person feels that is their problem because that's right in front of them. We try to limit our activities to items that give us the biggest bang for the buck. What I mean by that is we're consciously trying to get the most out of our investment, just like any other consumer. We go in and we do air sealing, insulating work, trying to keep things, like I say, very as cost effective as we can. I think it's a very good program in that regard. In regards to health and safety, to touch on that, maybe to answer some questions, what is being done is as a house is tightened up, we, through the use of the blower door, which measures the air tightness or exchange rate of the air in a house, once we know the tightness of the house and its occupancy, we can determine how much fresh air is required for that house to maintain a healthy environment for the inhabitants. And it has allowed us, with the extra funding for health and safety, it's allowed us to not only make their homes energy efficient, but also healthy. With the time constraints, I guess I will limit it to that. Any questions, feel free.
Thank you. I just have a quick question, and then Representative Garofalo has a question. Mr. McFarland, you said it when you had the ERA funding, you did 560 homes. Was that a year or in 1 year?
That, Madam Chairman, members, that was it was 683 homes, and that was over a two-year period. ERA went for the 2 years.
And Mr. McFarland, you said this year you're looking at under 80. I take it you got economic stimulus funds, but in terms of ongoing weatherization funding, is there a stream of state revenue that supports the work that the CAP agencies do across the state?
Madam Chairman, Madam Chair, members, there is no state money in the weatherization program. There's utility-funded weatherization. There's currently there's an EAP transfer out of the Low Income Energy Assistance Program, and that's currently it.
My last question, then we'll go to Representative Garofalo. With respect to the utility funding in the area of weatherization, do you have an idea of how much that is annually?
Madam Chair, we have a contract with Conexus for about $200,000 annually, and that provides Energy Star appliances to low-income people in the Conexus service area. And then we have a CenterPoint contract through the Minneapolis CAP agency, and that provides enough funding to do about 50 jobs a year.
Thank you. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. My question is for Deputy Commissioner Grant. And first of all, just to make clear, when I saw you over there, I was nudging you towards the table just to kind of speed things up. I wasn't trying to summon you to the table. Maybe my gesture was misunderstood. First of all, can we go back to that wonderful photo of you in the slideshow or not?
It looks like it could be my grandma's house, actually.
Yeah, my favorite part is the photobomb guy on the right-hand side who's kind of like beside you looking at the looking at it. But my question is with regards to, I think I understand this, that you had mentioned we're kind of getting punished because we spent our money, other states didn't do it. Can you just elaborate on that? I just want to make sure I understand that component of this.
Sure. Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, we received an allocation of the ERA money, as did all states, and all states were advised by the Department of Energy that they were to meet a production schedule in order to be able to take advantage of the money, and that there would be no extensions of the timeline within which they could spend that money. And so prudently, I think the department and the agencies really got busy and managed to complete the jobs that were required under that by the original deadline that was established, and many other states did not. Unfortunately, those states were permitted then to spend their remaining ERA dollars in that coming fiscal year. We didn't have any left to spend, and our allocation, though, was based on the fact that many states did have money remaining.
Gotcha. Okay. And then
Representative Garofalo. Mr. Brickwetty, did you want to add to that?
Very quickly, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, two things that I'd like to add. Commissioner Rothman did immediately send a letter to Secretary Chu on this issue, and there's been some correspondence back and forth. As Deputy Commissioner Grant indicated, we did feel like we were somewhat penalized for doing a good job, although that, I think that speaks volumes about the work that was done in Minnesota. And the second point is that I think that that does show the leadership that the state has taken in putting that money into the field and doing projects with it.
And Madam Chair, you know, it happened under the Bush administration. It happens under the Obama administration. It just doesn't. In Minnesota, we kind of got our act together, and I mean, it's unfortunate, but there's hundreds of examples on a bipartisan basis, regardless of who's running the federal government or the state, where this happens to us. And just more of a commentary on that. But regarding the $68 million amount. Talking too fast here. Does the governor, and I know this isn't the finance committee, but is the governor proposing any supplemental appropriation to the Department of Commerce to cover that? Is there any budget changes we should be aware of?
Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, no.
Okay. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner.
Mm-hmm. Members, in your packets, we reproduced the slides from the presentation yesterday on combined heat and power and waste energy, and I think it was the committee legislative assistant who made some color full-page printouts for you. I would encourage you to hang on to these, as well as to hang on to the information passed out by the weatherization folks, because we will be considering bills that pertain to these topic areas, and you may want to go back and look at them. And members, we are just about out of time. I know, Representative Beard, you have a question. I'm hoping you can ask offline. Representative Morgan, have you read the minutes?
I have absolutely read the minutes, Madam Chair. And I would move approval, adoption of the minutes from the February 11 meeting.
Madam All those Chair. In favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. No, I don't think you really read them. But the motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Representative Beard, we have, I think, like 20 seconds.
Well, Madam Chair, this is just for the committee's edification. When I was making my comments, I said that the previous commenter had made things that I took umbrage with. Thinking about it, umbrage is a big word that implies that I was personally offended, and that has a tendency to dampen and minimize discussion, which we definitely don't need in this committee. A better choice of words, say, I recollect that differently, or I beg to differ, but I assure you I was not personally offended by Andrew's comments, and I just wanted to make sure that the committee understood that it's important that we have dispassionate and free-flowing discussion here, and I didn't want anybody to think that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Beard. I hope that we're going to have the most bipartisan work product that we bring to the House floor. Keep our fingers crossed. This committee's adjourned.